ideas, usually, but rather that we cannot express them in any reasonable span of time. Hence, the elevator test. Can you explain your product and the time it takes to ride up in an elevator? Venture capitalists use this all the time as a test of investment potential. If you cannot pass the test, they don't invest. Here's why. 1. Whatever your claim is, it cannot be transmitted by word of mouth. In this medium, the unit of thought is at most a sentence or two. Beyond that, people cannot hold it in their heads. Since we have already established that word of mouth is fundamental to success in high-tech marketing, you must lose. 2. Your marketing communications will be all over the map. Every time someone writes a brochure, a presentation, or an ad, they will pick up the claim from some different corner and come up with yet another version of the positioning. Regardless of how good this version is, it will not reinforce the previous versions, and the marketplace will not get comfortable that it knows your position. A product with an uncertain position is very difficult to buy. 3. Your R&D will be all over the map. Again, since there are so many different dimensions to your positioning, engineering and product marketing can pick any number of different routes forward that may or may not add up to a real market advantage. You will have no clear winning proposition, but many strong losing ones. 4. You won't be able to recruit partners and allies because they won't be sure enough about your goals to make any meaningful commitments. What they will say instead, both to each other and to the rest of the industry, is, "Great technology, too bad they can't market." 5. You are not likely to get financing from anybody with experience. As just noted, most savvy investors know that if you can't pass the elevator test, among other things, you do not have a clear, that is, investable marketing strategy. So how can we guarantee passing the elevator test? The key is to define your position based on the target segment you intend to dominate and the value proposition you intend to dominate it with. Within this context, you then set forth your competition and the unique differentiation that belongs to you and that you expect to drive the buying decision your way. Here is a proven formula for getting all this down into 2 short sentences. Try it out on your own company and one of its key products. Just fill in the blanks. 4. Target customers, beachhead segment only, who are dissatisfied with the current market alternative. Our product is a new product category that provides key problem-solving capability, unlike the product alternative. We have assembled key whole product features for your specific application. Let's try this out with a few examples, starting with some we have already looked at earlier in the chapter. Silicon Graphics in Hollywood. 4 post-production film engineers who are dissatisfied with the limitations of traditional film editors. Our workstation is a digital film editor that lets you modify film images any way you choose. Unlike workstations from Sun, HP, or IBM, we have assembled all the interfaces needed for post-production film editing. Intuit. For the bill-paying member of the family who also uses a home PC, who is tired of filling out the same old checks month after month, Quicken is a PC home finance program that automatically creates and tracks all your check writing. Unlike managing your money, a financial analysis package, Our system is optimized specifically for home bill paying. Now, what is often interesting about writing a statement like this is not what you write down, but what you have to give up. In the case of Silicon Graphics, the workstation can be used with all kinds of programs besides film editing per se. Film editors could run project management software on it, access the internet, send email, keep databases of customer contacts, and the like. And in the case of Intuit, Quicken also lets you budget more effectively, and it keeps records for tax season that can be fed directly into Intuit's TurboTax for home filing. Wouldn't it have been better to load in these extra value statements for a bigger effect? The answer here is an emphatic no. Indeed, this is just what defeats most positioning efforts. Remember, the goal of positioning is to create and occupy a space inside the target customer's head. Now, as we already noted, people are very conservative about what they let you do inside their head. One of the things they do not like is for you to take up too much space. This means they will use a kind of shorthand reference. Mercedes, top of the line, conservative. BMW, upscale performance sedan, yuppie. Cadillac, American top of the line, tired. Lexus, new kid on the block, current best buy. That's all the space you get for your primary differentiation statement. It's like a telegram with less than one line. If you don't make the choice to fill the space with a single attribute, then the market will do it for you. And since the market includes your competition trying to unposition you, don't count on it to be kind. Let's try another example. This one from one of our startups. Channel point. For insurance providers distributing through independent agents who can no longer afford to bear the overhead of the general agent system. ChannelPoint is an internet-based insurance distribution system that uses computers to provide round-the-clock service to selling agents. Unlike Yahoo or any other general-purpose internet services site, we provide the complete suite of information and services needed to support your field selling force. Note how the two reference competitors, the market alternative and the product alternative, help the listener's mind triangulate to find the new position. Positioning is not about hype. It's about clear and precise direction. One final point on claims before moving on to other issues. The statement of position is not the tagline for the ad. Ad agencies come up with taglines, not marketing groups. The function of the statement of position is to control the ad campaign, to ensure that however creative it may become, it stays on strategy. If the point of the ad is not identical with the point of the claim, then it is the ad, not the claim, that must be changed, regardless of how great the ad is. The shifting burden of proof. The toughest thing about high-tech marketing is that just about the time you get the hang of something, it becomes obsolete. This is even true of something as innocent as providing evidence. That is, like everything else in high-tech, the kind of evidence that is needed evolves over the course of the technology adoption lifecycle. This can be summarized within the structure of the competitive positioning compass, which you can view in the enhanced portion of this audiobook. By working your way up the left and then up the right of the compass, you can trace the evolution of desired evidence as the market evolves from the technology enthusiast to the visionary to the pragmatist and conservative. The key point to notice is the transition from product to market, corresponding to crossing the chasm. This is simply a corroboration of a point we have been making all along, that pragmatists are more interested in the market's response to a product than in the product itself. What is particularly awkward for a high-tech company making this transition is that for the first time, the major sources of desired evidence are not directly under its control. This is not a matter of having the right features or winning the right benchmark war. It is a matter of other people, theoretically disinterested third parties, voting to endorse your product through not only words, but deeds. It is actual investment in building the whole product that demonstrates to the pragmatist that if you are not already the market segment leader, you are destined to become so. In sum, to the pragmatist buyer, the most powerful evidence of leadership and likelihood of competitive victory is market share. In the absence of definitive numbers here, pragmatists will look to the quality and number of partners and allies you have assembled in your camp, and their degree of demonstrable commitment to your cause. The kind of evidence this buyer is looking for is signs of co-marketing, such as joint sales calls and cross-referencing each other's products in sales literature, and consistent mutual support, even when the other party is not present in the room. This point leads directly into communication strategy for crossing the chasm. Not only do you have to develop this kind of evidence of whole product support, you also have to make sure that everyone hears about it. Whole product launches. The concept of a whole product launch is a derivative of the widely known practice of a product launch. That is, whenever a new high-tech product is introduced, it is customary to launch it by first briefing the industry analysts and long lead press editors well in advance of the launch date so they can serve as references, and then taking the top company executives on a tour to the weekly trade press the week prior to announcement, with the announcement itself capped by an event. These product launches work just fine when the product itself is new news. Then, they are an appropriate tool for the development of early markets. By the same token, however, they are not appropriate for crossing the chasm. At this point, the product is not new news. At least it had better not be if we are planning to win over the pragmatist buyer. The trade press is not interested, therefore, in a great trumpeting article on release 3.0. Not unless, that is, you are a Microsoft, but that's another story. So if the message is not, "Look at my hot new product," then what is it? And how are you going to get it out? The message now is, "Look at this hot new market." The message typically consists of a description of the emerging new market, fed by an emerging set of partners and allies, each supplying a part of the whole product puzzle, to the satisfaction of an increasingly visible and growing set of customers. The lure embedded in this story is that we are seeing a new trend in the making, and everyone who has a seat on this bandwagon is going to be in on the big win. This is a great story for small entrepreneurial companies to be able to tell, because it gives them a credibility that they cannot achieve on their own. Their product does not even have to be at the center of the puzzle. It just has to be an indispensable piece, as Oracle's relational database is to ERP, regardless of which application vendor is chosen, or Rambus's memory interface will be in upcoming generations of PCs, regardless of which PC vendor is chosen. Now, how can marketing communications improve your odds? First, marketers have to pick the right communications venue. There are two venues in general that lend themselves to whole product stories. The first is the business press. Whole product stories, particularly ones sparked by partnerships and alliances coming together to bring off some wonderful result for a particular company, are the bread and butter of business fare. Companies organizing to bring off this feat consistently and thereby dominate a particular market segment are particularly of interest. If the company is brand new, to be sure, the business press is leery. In this instance, it is important first to build some references in the financial analyst community, based not on the company per se, but on the market opportunity it has in its sights. Financial analysts are usually quite open to briefings on emerging market opportunities, and in that context, can be wooed to take an interest in an emerging entrepreneurial venture. Once they have bought into the market, then they can be used as a reference point by the business press in developing a story. In bringing this story to the business press, it is important to bring along as many of the other players in the market as possible. One effective tactic is to hold a press conference with multiple spokespersons on the dais: customers, analysts, partners, distributors, and so on. A more elaborate version of the same approach is to sponsor a conference on the core issue that is driving the development of this market. The key objective in either case is to communicate the bandwagon effect in progress. Finally, communicating via the business press has to be done within the framework of a big idea. Technology stories, told at the level of technology, are only interesting as vignettes, squibs for the column that leads the second section of the Wall Street Journal. For a technology story to be a business story, it has to be about something that transcends high tech. Typically, the seed of the story is either a new type of opportunity or problem that can now be addressed effectively because of advances in the industry. These advances will have been sparked by technology breakthroughs, and that will be part of the story. But they are now seen to extend to the entire whole product infrastructure, and that will be the main thrust of the story. The great benefit of the business press as a medium of communication is its high degree of credibility across virtually all business buying situations. This is a two-edged sword for the entrepreneurial company. In order to preserve its credibility, the business press is reluctant to endorse entrepreneurial enterprises until they have been well proved. It takes a long time, in other words, to earn coverage. On the other hand, having broken through in this medium once, it is much easier to do so again. Furthermore, subsequent product-oriented coverage in the trade press tends to become more thorough as the company attains greater stature in the business press. So building relationships with business press editors, initially around a whole product story, is a key tactic in crossing the chasm. In addition to the business press, the other communications channel for getting out a whole product message is what could be loosely termed vertical media. That is, media specifically dedicated to a particular industry or a particular profession. Industry trade shows and conferences, meetings of professional associations, and publications dedicated to a specific market segment all tend to attract pragmatists and conservatives, people who put a high value on maintaining relationships within their group. These associations are relatively open to participation from supporting vendors, provided that the vendors are not too obtrusive with their sales messages. Whole product issues are ideal for this kind of communications. The idea is to get in a room with a number of people in a given industry and outline the current state of affairs in the vendor's marketplace as it relates to their business. Correctly framed, these sessions put the customer, rather than the vendor or the vendor's product, at the center of things. They align themselves with the customer's needs and the alternatives available to meet those needs. Thus, although they are at one level clearly self-serving to the vendor, they do not feel self-serving, positioning the vendor more as a consultant than as a salesperson. The goal of a whole product launch campaign overall is to develop relationships in support of a positive word-of-mouth campaign for your company and products. The first thing to remember is that developing these relationships takes time. Time to ferret out who are the key influencers, time to get to know them on more or less equal footing, time to get up to speed on the industry issues so that the relationship is pertinent and valuable to both parties. The other thing to remember is that once these relationships are in place, they represent a major barrier to entry for any competitor. Pragmatists and conservatives, the core of any mainstream market, like to do business with people they know. Recap: the competitive positioning checklist. To define the battle effectively so that you win the business of a pragmatist buyer, you must 1. Focus the competition within the market segment established by your must-have value proposition. That is, that combination of target customer, product offering, and compelling reason to buy that establishes your primary reason for being. 2. Create the competition around what, for a pragmatist buyer, represents a reasonable and reasonably comprehensive set of alternative ways of achieving this value proposition. Do not tamper with this set by artificially excluding a reasonable competitor. Nothing is more likely to alienate your pragmatist buyer. 3. Focus your communications by reducing your fundamental competitive claim to a two-sentence formula, and then managing every piece of company communication to ensure that it always stays within the bounds set out by that formula. In particular, always be sure to reinforce the second sentence of this claim, the one that identifies your primary competition and how you are differentiated from it. 4. Demonstrate the validity of your competitive claim through the quality of your whole product solution and the quality of your partners and allies, so that the pragmatist buyer will conclude you are, or must shortly become, the indisputable leader of this competitive set. 7. Launch the invasion. In this chapter, the final pieces of the D-Day strategy come into play: distribution and pricing. As we launch our invasion across the chasm, distribution is the vehicle that will carry us on our mission, and pricing is its fuel. These two issues are the only two points where marketing decisions come into direct contact with a new mainstream customer. Decisions in both distribution and pricing, therefore, have enormous strategic impact. And with distribution in particular, there is typically only one chance to get it right. For this reason, we have put these two last in our invasion planning sequence, so that we could have the advantage of nailing everything else down first. The number one corporate objective when crossing the chasm is to secure a channel into the mainstream market with which the pragmatist customer will be comfortable. This objective comes before revenues, before profits, before press, even before customer satisfaction. All these other factors can be fixed later, but only if the channel is established. Or, to put it the other way around, if the channel is not established, nothing further can be accomplished. Finally, given that establishing the channel is the number one goal, The fundamental function of pricing during the same period is to achieve the same end. In other words, during the chasm period, the number one concern of pricing is not to satisfy the customer or to satisfy the investors, but to motivate the channel. To sum up, when crossing the chasm, we are looking to attract customer-oriented distribution. And one of our primary lures will be distribution-oriented pricing. These are somewhat radical words, and they are going to require considerable discussion. In order for this discussion to make any sense, however, we need first to review the somewhat tumultuous state of distribution as we are poised to enter the next century. There is, at present, a structural problem in the distribution function for high tech, one that may well work itself out eventually, but probably not in time to solve any of our immediate problems. Once we understand that problem, then we can better chart our chasm-crossing strategy. The structure of high-tech distribution. There are currently a wide variety of distribution channels operating under the umbrella of the high-tech market. The most prominent are the following. Direct sales. Typically national in scope and focused on calling on major accounts. This consists of a dedicated sales force in the direct employ of the vendor, with no other intermediary between the customer and the company. IBM has the most famous direct sales force in the world. Two-tier retail. In the retail market, this represents a distributor like Mericel, Tech Data, or Ingram, playing the first-tier role, which is backward-facing toward the supply chain, and an outlet such as CompuWare playing the customer-facing role. Vendors ship to the first tier, which stages inventory and manages credit for the second tier. This structure, which was at its most powerful during the late 1980s, is increasingly being displaced by the next two channels. One-tier retail. These are the superstores, like CompUSA and Fry's, that for the bulk of goods sold fulfill both the wholesale and retail functions in a single entity. Increasingly squeezed profit margins are forcing this restructuring, especially in the PC market, where so much of the product line has been commoditized. Internet retail. This is either one or two-tier, and is optimized for consumer offers that do not need significant configuration or support. The fact that Dell does both is a testimony not to the channel, but to the company. Witness the difficulty its competitors had matching up. Two-tier value-added reselling. For products that are too complex for retail, the two-tier model continues to work when the customer-facing role is played by a VAR. These are typically no-name companies which specialize in a particular technology, say websites, or a particular vertical market, say CAD or publishing, and operate normally within the confines of a single city. National roll-ups. From time to time, the market makes a move to roll up local VARs into a nationwide chain. The first attempts were tried with the NetWare VAR network during the 1980s, but fell afoul of Novell's fall from grace. More recently, U.S. Web is attempting a similar strategy with Web VARs. Most successful to date, perhaps, has been Icon, with its roll-up of copier sales and service outlets, upon which it is now seeking to overlay PC, LAN, and web service provisioning. OEMs, Original Equipment Manufacturers. This is at least a two-tier transaction, beginning with a direct sales force selling to manufacturers, who then integrate the purchased product into their own systems and sell the systems onto the customer. If the OEM product is bought through industrial distributors and sold through retail or VARs, there can actually be as many as 4 tiers to this channel. The big computer manufacturers, just like the big automakers, all purchase products on an OEM basis from the rest of the industry. Systems integrators. This is not a channel per se, since it rarely, if ever, sells the same products twice. Rather, it is a project-oriented institution for managing very large or very complex computer projects. Since, however, such projects often design in standards that are then replicated throughout the rest of the company's operations, there are good reasons to treat systems integrators like a channel. But all of the above, to some extent, shrinks in comparison to the looming impact of the greatest change to distribution methods perhaps ever, namely, the Internet. The challenge this poses for chasm crossers facing the turn of the century is that most of this impact has yet to be felt, and planning on the Internet channel for the short term is not a good strategy. Just as important, however, is the opposite caveat. Not planning for the Internet as part of your long-term distribution strategy will be fatal. The cost of interacting on the Internet with either a prospect or a repeat customer is so much lower, and the ability to shape that experience is so much higher, that every commercial enterprise will have to incorporate this medium eventually. Channels are optimized for different purposes as follows. 1. Demand creators versus demand fulfillers. Direct sales forces, for example, are optimized for creating demand, while retail superstores are optimized for fulfilling it. A lot of other channels commit to do both, are optimized for neither, and suffer the consequences. When crossing the chasm, our immediate goal is to create mainstream demand. But we must also look ahead toward putting in place a channel that can fulfill it. 2. Role in providing the whole product. Systems integrators and VARs are optimized for playing a very large role in providing or developing the whole product and make much of their profits from this service. By contrast, retail and internet channels take a low-cost position based on the assumption that the whole product is already institutionalized and can be fully assembled from off-the-shelf parts. Again, there are a number of channels caught in the middle, the most visible of which at the moment is the mall-based retail storefront. In the chasm case, the goal is to take the burden of whole product off of the channel in order to free it up to spend more time creating and fulfilling demand for the product. 3. Potential for high volume. In some ways, this is simply the obverse of the previous category. Channels optimized for whole product development are not effective for high volume delivery. There is too much labor in their business mix, so that when business is booming, they tend to slow down their selling efforts to work off some of the backlog, thereby flattening what could otherwise be meteoric growth. The low-cost, low-service channels are just the opposite. Optimized for high volumes, they are great for boom times, but they do not do well in startup mode and tend to panic and dump when business softens, thereby trashing not only their own margins, but yours as well. In the chasm case, our ultimate target is likely to be a high-volume channel. This is something like getting a car into high gear. The question is, how do we get it up to speed? What we are looking for in general as we cross the chasm is the following. First and foremost, does the channel already have Or is it optimized to create a relationship with our target mainstream customer? If not, then it is not a candidate for helping us cross the chasm. If, nonetheless, it is our customer's ultimate preferred form of distribution, then we are going to have to look for a two-step process where we have an intermediate distribution tactic to create the relationship and a longer-term one to reap maximum rewards. Second, how will this channel fit into our whole product mix, our partners and allies strategy? The less pressure we put on the channel to deliver the whole product, the more it can focus on selling instead of supporting. On the other hand, it is absolutely critical that our mainstream customer gets the whole product, and we should be willing to sacrifice some volume in order to prevent customer dissatisfaction at getting less than the whole product. With these factors in mind, let's take a closer look at some of the more prominent channels in operation today, and specifically, how they stack up against our immediate goal of crossing the chasm. Direct sales. Historically, the most consistently successful channel in high tech has been the direct sales force. More than anything else, it was IBM's mastery of this medium that drove it to prominence and then dominance in the 1960s and 1970s. Other companies have successfully copied this act, be they DEC and HP for mid-range systems, Oracle and Computer Associates for system software, SAP and PeopleSoft for enterprise application software, or Cisco and Ascend for networking hardware. The direct sales force is optimized for creating demand. At its center is a consultative salesperson who works with the client in needs analysis, and then, supported by a team of application and technology specialists, develops and proposes solutions, which, after additional interaction with the customer and a competitive procurement, turn into purchase orders. This is a very expensive way to sell, with the cost of sales built into the product's price. It works reasonably well when two conditions are met. For the customer, the key condition is that the vendor supply a broadly comprehensive and reasonably competitive set of offerings. If this condition is not met, it means that additional vendor interactions are needed. There is only so much time and effort the customer is willing to put into educating and negotiating with vendors. So breadth of product line is crucial here. For the vendor, the key condition is both the volume and the predictability of revenues. To support a single consultative salesperson requires a revenue stream of anywhere from $500,000 to several million dollars, depending on the amount of pre-sales and post-sales support provided. Say our quota is $1,200,000. That means we must close $100,000 per month. If the sales cycle is 6 to 9 months, and if we are able to close one out of every two opportunities, then we have to have either 12 to 18 $100,000 prospects in the pipeline at all times, not very probable, or some smaller number of significantly larger deals going. One underlying point here is that there is a price point below which this method of distribution cannot work. If we have to be working $500,000 opportunities, we cannot be selling a product whose base price is $20,000. It turns out the practical limit for base product price point is around $75,000, with variations depending on the level of selling support required and the speed and predictability of the sales cycle. Another underlying point is the importance of what salespeople call account control, but which might more accurately be termed account cooperation. Direct sales forces can bring lots of service to an account, but not if they lose the deal during the competitive procurement. Basically, then, for this system to work, there has to be a fundamentally uncompetitive agenda operating. A, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours agreement, under which vendors are granted a limited monopoly, subject to their not exploiting it egregiously and continuing to provide premium service. This confers a high degree of predictability of revenue and a lower cost of sales. When functioning at its best, within the limits just laid out, direct sales is the optimal channel for high tech. It is also the best channel for crossing the chasm. Nonetheless, it is currently under heavy fire from a number of different directions. First, wherever vendors have been able to achieve lock-in with customers through proprietary technology, there has been the temptation to exploit the relationship through unfairly expensive maintenance agreements topped by charging for some new releases, as if they were new products. This was one of the main forces behind the Open Systems Rebellion that undermined so many vendors' account control, which, in turn, decreased predictability of revenues, putting the system further in jeopardy. A second consequence of the open systems competition has been the dramatic increase in the relative value or price performance of computers and the consequent drop in average selling price. This has been further exacerbated by the rise of NT, displacing the Unix servers at the low end and beginning to move upstream, further commoditizing the platform and driving out the opportunity to preserve product margins through proprietary differentiation. As price points lower, it becomes increasingly difficult to sell through a direct sales force. This, in turn, puts heavy pressure on companies with direct sales forces already in place, the many computer companies in the Northeast are a prime example, to field sufficient product to generate the kind of revenue volumes needed to maintain this high overhead channel. Working against the success of that effort is the fact that the complexity of total solutions has increased to the point where no single vendor can cover a big piece of the pie. This undermines the primary customer benefit of account cooperation with a direct sales force. The simplifying of vendor relationships, and the improved accountability of working with a single vendor. Now there are too many cooks involved, and major accounts are looking to other kinds of channels, notably systems integrators, for this kind of overall problem simplification. Now, against this background, let us look at direct sales as a distribution alternative for crossing the chasm. To qualify at all, our product must have an appropriate price point. So let's assume it does. We like a direct sales approach because it is optimized for creating demand, something very much on our minds. What then are the issues to consider? Our first issue is, can we get our sales force entry into the pragmatists' restricted domain? Obviously, if you hire good enough people and hammer loud enough at the door, you can gain some level of entry. What we really mean here is, do we have a partner or ally who already has a relationship with our target customer and who can help open the door from the inside? Without that sort of leverage, a direct sales force, particularly in its first year of existence, can be very expensive indeed, as you can end up paying very high wages to people who are essentially spending most of their time doing low-grade prospecting and resenting every minute of it. A strong tactic to consider here is hiring a senior executive out of the target community to become your company's ambassador back in. This should be someone who has a deep understanding of the business issues in the community and relationships of long standing that can be leveraged to introduce sales teams to appropriate prospects. The alternative to this is to rely on a strategic partner's relationships. But this is dangerous because you need direct access to the entire customer organization if you're going to emerge from this market as its leader. Nonetheless, it can be done. And this approach will be discussed later in this chapter under Selling Partnerships. Our second issue is, do we have the capability to recruit and grow a direct sales force appropriate to the market opportunity? It is certainly possible for a company to create outstanding early market success and not have any significant kind of sales force management capability. Indeed, such capabilities may be countercultural to the firm. If such is the case, then setting out to build a direct sales force can be a very dangerous proposition. An all-too-typical failed scenario begins with bringing in one or more high-priced, highly ambitious sales executives who, in trying to create a winning sales situation, run roughshod over the existing culture, politicize the management environment, create divisiveness both within the executive staff and between that group and its investors, and, in general, reduce the effectiveness of the team just at the time when it is being most challenged. A reasonable alternative here is to field a direct sales force as a transition-oriented tactic, with a long-term goal to take the product into a different channel through a selling partnership. This will represent a major reduction in overall return on investment, since he who owns the customer owns the profit margins and the future of the product. But it also represents a major reduction in risk and potential grief. This is not the macho high-tech way, of course, which in my view gives it added attractiveness. All other things being equal, however, direct sales is the preferred alternative because it gives us maximum control over our own destiny. And as we also noted, even if we cannot pass these tests, because creating demand is so important when crossing the chasm, we may well want to copy many techniques from direct sales to supplement or transition to whatever distribution channel we finally select. Retail sales. The second most successful channel in high tech has been the retail sales organization brought into existence by the personal computer and its ever-broadening, highly institutionalized whole product entourage. That is, what the PC brought to the industry for the first time was an open platform with standard hardware and software interfaces. This meant that thousands of vendors could create and supply the parts of an industry-standard whole product, thereby institutionalizing that whole product and opening up the opportunity for retail. Since its initial appearance in the 1980s, with stores like the Bike Shop, retail sales has continually evolved and morphed along with the PC industry. There was a time, for example, when dedicated stores looked like the right venue, and both IBM and Xerox experimented with same. But it soon became clear the selection, rather than brand, was the driving force, with an additional emphasis on service to the business customer. At this stage, business land and computer land rose to prominence. Then, as the PC became increasingly commoditized, larger and larger storefronts gained competitive advantage, and we saw the rise of superstores like CompUSA and Fry's. Concurrently, catalog stores like PC and Mac Warehouse created a mail-order channel. Then, for a while, the big consumer warehouse outlets like the Price Club and Walmart had the inside track, particularly for the home market. While on the business side, New challengers emerged in Staples and Office Depot. Most recently, direct distribution as practiced by Dell Computer has become the most effective channel. Whether customers are interacting over the phone or increasingly now over the internet. Overall, retail offers a staggering array of alternatives. And if we are going to be successful in crossing the chasm, we need to step back and operate from the first principles. First and foremost, the retail system works optimally when its job is to fulfill demand rather than to create it. Unlike direct sales, it does not support the consultative sale. It cannot explain complex software or facilitate complex integration of products. It is not, in other words, well set up to be a participant in developing the whole product. Rather, it is structured to leverage an institutionalized whole product by supporting convenient access to a broad selection of brand choices, providing these choices at the lowest possible prices, and, in the process of so doing, serving as a credit broker among the intermediary parties in the distribution chain. Now, in a sense, as far as crossing the chasm is concerned, we need go no further. Because it does not create demand, and because it does not help develop whole products, retail distribution is structurally unsuited to solving the chasm problem. The overwhelming bulk of retail sales go to companies that have solidly established brands. That has always been the bias of retail, whether the shelves are filled with hardware or software or with clothing or consumer packaged goods. If you need to create demand, you need much more focus and face time than the traditional outlet can provide. Dedicated outlets in retail, think Starbucks, The Body Shop, or Smith & Hawkins, can help drive new brands into the market, particularly if they are backed up by catalog sales. But to date, the only comparable outlet that has emerged in high tech has been around the cell phone. For the most part, retail simply cannot sponsor discontinuous innovations because they require the channel to spend a disproportionate and ultimately unproductive amount of time on something that gives too low a rate of return. The ultimate consequence of this for the retail channel is extremely serious. In a typical supermarket, more than 1,000 new products are introduced in a single year, and much of the volume sold through comes from these promotions. To be fair, these products are not really new. Most are simple repackagings or a minor variation on an already accepted good. But they do have at least some novelty to offer. High-tech products, by contrast, tend to be really new, as in incompatible with the prior release and the various co-marketed products that accompanied that release. To introduce this kind of novelty requires coordinating a host of collateral products and staffing a sales force that understands what goes with what. It is a ruinous modification to the retail formula. And until the industry truly matures, it puts all such channels in a deep quandary. So let us rephrase our interest in the retail channel. Let's say we have a product that, once it is established in the mainstream market, will be a natural candidate for retail distribution. Now, how should we proceed? Simply put, we need some intermediary step during which we can create the demand and institutionalize the whole product, and then turn it over to the channel. Some proven approaches include the following. 1. Direct response advertising. This works particularly well for developing demand for low-priced software products, such as Intuit's Quicken, the check-writing package for use in the home or small business, where the risk of trial is not great and the whole product infrastructure is already in place. By varying the pitch in the ads, marketers can sort out which reasons to buy are truly compelling. Once the demand itself is demonstrated and the pitch proven, then the product can be readily absorbed by the channel. 2. Telesales and teleservice. This works better for higher-priced products, like Dell's line of PC-compatible computers, where the company was able to target a particular kind of pragmatist customer, power users, and provide them with better-than-retail service through highly trained and motivated people working over the phone. The low cost of sales was passed on to these customers as lower prices, and because the customers were unusually knowledgeable, even complex product discussions could be accomplished without face-to-face meetings and demos. And now that Dell's brand has been established, voice-to-voice, it is branching out over the internet to create even lower cost of sales as customers engage in the first generation of self-service purchasing of high-tech products. 3. Value-added resellers. Later, we are going to discuss this channel separately, analyzing its suitability for long-term participation in the mainstream market. But here, we are looking at it simply as a transitional vehicle. It is an excellent vehicle for developing whole product support, although it is not particularly motivated to package or institutionalize these solutions. It is only fair at creating demand, for although it uses a consultative approach, it tends to be dominated by problem solvers rather than salespeople, and so sometimes lacks basic selling skills. Nonetheless, for whole products, which simply cannot commoditize easily, ones that have some level of irreducible complexity, the VAR channel can often be the right choice for crossing the chasm. We saw this in the 1980s, where Novell succeeded with Lands and Autodesk with PCCAD. And we are seeing it in the 1990s, where Internet VARs are setting up the first generation of websites for small businesses. All three of these techniques, then, serve the chasm-crossing strategy by bridging between an immediate need to create demand and/or institutionalize the whole product, after which the product can be turned over to the retail channel in order to leverage that channel's high-volume capabilities. Now, because this product will ultimately end up in retail, there's an upper limit to its price point, typically a few thousand dollars for a consumer, up to perhaps $10,000 for a small business owner. Beyond that point, demands for service and other elements of the whole product simply exceed the retail channel's ability to supply. This leads us to notice an extremely significant discontinuity in the spectrum of channel choices. The space between the high end of retail, say $10,000, and the low end of direct sales, say $75,000. What goes in between? VAR land or no man's land? Today, the domain between $10,000 and $75,000 is where the structural problem in high-tech distribution is taking its greatest toll. Products in this range provide all the challenges of high-priced products and all the margins of low-priced ones. This creates a very painful squeeze on the vendor. And this squeeze is currently driving a brutal shakeout in the computer industry. The most visible product line caught in this squeeze is the departmental system designed for the commercial market. Traditionally Unix-based, this has now been reconfigured around an NT-based server. But that has not alleviated the pricing problem, for the total investment required still falls squarely in the middle of the structural gap. Approaching from the bottom end, there is no way the traditional retail channel can provide the services and support needed to install and maintain such systems. Coming from the high end, There is no way that a traditional direct sale and services channel can pay back its cost of servicing such small deals. This is not to say that there is no channel for products in the 10,000